Over the course of this past year, we raised our first pigs here on the farm. About a week ago, we harvested them both. And although I realize this topic is not for everyone, we do share and discuss all homesteading topics here in Hearth and Home. And I do think there is a great value specifically in sharing a first-timer's experience in doing something like this. So the internet, you know, it's full of great books and incredible stories from experienced farmers. But if you are green, like we were and still kind of are, and you're thinking about going down this road, I imagine you are sitting there with all the same questions we had at the beginning. We have access to incredible friends and resources online and in our local communities. But often these good people have years of experience and in their sharing are so far beyond being new at it that they might gloss over minute details as those things are just ingrained in them at this point. So while it's all still fresh in my mind, I want to capture and share as much as I can about our first experience raising and butchering pigs. Please know if this topic isn't for you, that I will not be offended if you choose to skip this one. That is totally fine. You do what you need to do. Welcome to episode 26 of the Hearth and Home podcast. I am Heather, and this is a place to honor, celebrate, and share all things related to Hearth and Home. In this episode, I would like to cover three main areas with you, all from a first-timer's perspective. The first being selecting the breed that we chose, and then the raising of them, what our setup was, our experiences in raising them, how we fed them, all of that sort of thing. The second part of this episode is going to discuss the day of the kill. So how we went about that, what it looked like, how it felt, all of that stuff. These are really important things to acknowledge and to discuss. And then the third section will be about processing, breaking down the animals, getting them ready for the freezer, that sort of thing. We have been raising meat birds, chicken, for a few years now, so we have some experience with raising food, you know, that is meat on our land, but this was a first for a larger animal and something that we would have for a longer period of time. So we've raised two kinds of meat birds here, Cornish Cross and Freedom Rangers. And the Cornish Cross are butchered at 7 weeks, and the Freedom Rangers were butchered at 12 weeks. So it's a shorter duration of time with these animals, which means the whole experience is different. The relationship is different. The pigs that we got were Mangalitsa, which is a breed from Hungary. It's a heritage breed. They almost went extinct in the 1990s. There was a very small handful of these pigs left. They weren't brought to this country, the United States, until about 13 years ago, maybe about 14 or 15 now. So a lot of people don't know about them. They're a very slow-growing breed of pig. They are known for their lard content. So they have excellent quality lard, but also a lot of it. And their meat is quite red. It's called the Kobe beef of pork. The marbleization in the meat is incredible. You know, sometimes people say if you were to serve somebody something and they didn't know it wasn't beef, they would think that it was. We love beef. I actually don't care for a lot of the ultra lean, pale pink pork that's out there. There's just not much flavor to it. Dries out very easily in the cooking process. So I was really intrigued by this particular breed. And also I have sampled the meat from a breeder here in Vermont. And yeah, I mean, it was incredible. And if you didn't know better, you would think you were having a ribeye steak. I thought, well, I'm not set up here to raise beef at this time, so this might be the next best thing. And of course, bacon and sausage and all of those wonderful pork foods that we love. The other characteristic of Mangalitsa pigs that is unique is they look woolly. Their hair, it is hair, it's not wool. It looks curly like a sheep. And people will often, especially there's different colors of Mangalitsas, and there is one particular color called blonde, and we had one of those. And really, if you were just passing by in a car and you saw her out of the corner of your eye, you would think she was a sheep. So they're unique in that way also. They are incredible rooters, and I'm not at all a pig expert, but my understanding is some breeds do just sort of graze on pasture, but these pigs do not. They will turn over your earth, which is what we wanted, because the area, or one of the areas that we ran them through 15, 20 years ago, I'm not sure, I forget at the moment, but was full cedar forest here on our land, and it was logged about that time ago. So there's just a lot of just debris still in the ground and stumps and logs that were left behind. And it's just kind of a bit of a messy area, but it's a good area because it's flat and dry and could potentially be a second orchard for us down the road or pasture. But it was really difficult to develop as a pasture until something went through there and worked that earth. And so pigs are really good for that. The meat quality, the lard quality, the work that they would do here with our land, so many factors. We were just intrigued by this breed, and we found someone in Springfield, Vermont, top of the hill farm, Betsy. She's awesome. We went with her and got two gilts, so two young females from her, and raised them. We picked them up last April 26th, and they were butchered this year on April 29th. Now, they were almost 3 months old when we picked them up, so by the time they were butchered was 15 months old, which is also a little unusual and a big consideration if you're raising a breed like this. They are slower growing, so you're not going to pick them up in the spring and butcher them in the fall. They need longer time to grow out than that. It turns a lot of people off because that means more time feeding them. This particular breed is built for winter, so that part was not a concern at all. It was just, you have to acknowledge that you're going to be feeding them longer, which we were fine with, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. One of the more important points that I would like to make and share with you is that you don't need to feel like you know everything there is to know about a certain animal before you bring it onto your farm or homestead. I know we can get wrapped up in the education of things before the experience of things, but a lot of people then wind up watching years pass them by, and they're stuck in paralysis by analysis. Now, this is an affliction that I actually never have at all in my life by nature. That doesn't mean I'm incredibly risky and spontaneous, because I'm also not. I am a fairly cautious and careful person, but I also just have an instinct for knowing when enough is enough, and sometimes you need to read a good handful of books, spend time with mentors, and eventually you just need to bite the bullet and jump in, because you learn by doing. And that goes for everybody. Now, there are some basic things that, of course, you responsibly do need to have in place before you bring any kind of animals onto your homestead. And I know that there are plenty of really resourceful, creative people out there who are able to pull these things off for very little money. That wasn't really my situation. I don't think it cost a ton of money to bring them on initially, but it did cost some money, and so we needed to factor that in. But what we're looking at is obviously, you know, a designated location on your property where this is going to work. They're going to need shade, shelter, so those can kind of dual purpose. They're going to need good fencing. You're going to need to think about what you are going to feed them and have some of that lined up. And they're going to need clean water. And when you're choosing your area for them, especially if you're raising something that's going to take so long to grow out, like a Mangalitsa, you need to be able to rotate your animals through. And that really does go for any length of time that you are raising something, ideally. I mean, I know there's a lot of situations out there where people do not have that option. It's not ideal, but I do know people that do it quite attentively and their animals are still healthy and thriving. So I don't want to pass any judgment there at all. But it is true, if you can provide a rotation, then that is ideal. And we found, well, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but we found that our first rotation, they were able to stay in longer, like I think it was like 2 or 3 months, because they were so little. But then once they sized up, we definitely were moving them every 4 to 6 weeks. But we had the space to do pretty large paddocks and we wanted this area large. So we made that work. But think about rotation. Think about whether you have pasture or forage, depending on the animal. And certainly we're talking here today mostly about pigs. So our pigs, they're fine with either. I mean, they loved the grassy areas. They just rooted them up and ate them and turned them over. But some animals actually just thrive on pasture alone. So pigs, pasture or forage, but certainly shade, water, good food, excellent fencing, a plan to rotate them. So if you have the space and you have a bit of resources to pull this together, but yet you have been sitting on the fence, the decision fence, for years now, just always think you're going to read one more book. Listen, basic knowledge is good and responsible, but attentive experience will be your best teacher. So go ahead and get started. Now, I would be remiss here if I did not take a moment to discuss our fencing setup with you, because it was 110% effective. And this was incredibly important to me to get right from the get-go, because as many of you know, I am here alone a lot, several days a week. My husband works out of state. And I just, you know, I did not want to deal with escaping pigs. And you hear about this all the time. It's common and you need to expect it when you're raising pigs. And I was not willing to expect it. So I definitely did my homework on this one. And I came across a man in Michigan. His name is Mark Baker, and he has a YouTube channel and a website called Baker's Green Acres. I will provide a link for you. He raises Mangalitsas. I'm pretty sure he's one of the more significant Mangalitsa breeders in the country. Mark had some really good teachings on his YouTube channel, I believe it was his YouTube channel, about fencing, and he swears by a particular method. And he's been doing this a long time with this particular breed. So I was like, you know what? I actually don't know a thing about this. All I know is all of my friends, particularly on Instagram, where there's so many people showing photos of things, who have pigs, always talk about their pigs got out, their pigs got out. And I was not interested in dealing with that if there was anything I could do to prevent it. So Mark has this system where you surround your paddock, and you can create multiples of these if that's what you're going to do. And that's what we did. We created multiple paddocks. So it was a little bit more labor intensive, but not terrible. It worked. So it was worth it to us. So you surround your paddock with T-posts and field fencing. And this is your perimeter fence. This is not actually what keeps the pigs in. This is your just in case layer. What actually keeps the pigs inside their area is a single strand electric wire that is right at about snout level. So we had it a little bit lower when they were younger, and we raised it up in subsequent paddocks as they grew. So about 12 inches is considered where you want to start it out. And this was really easy to install because we just used the wraparound T-post extender insulators. You can get them at Tractor Supply. You can get them, I think, from Premier One. You can get them at all kinds of places. And they clip onto the T-post, and they have an arm that reaches out about 5 or 6 inches. Mark had suggested 12 inches out. I think he did anyway. We couldn't find 12-inch extenders, so we went with what we could find, and they're 5 or 6 inches extending out from the T-post. So this insulator clips on to the T-post, has an arm that extends about 6 inches beyond that, and there you string your single strand wire. And of course, you're going to need a charger, whether that be a hardwired charger or a solar one. You can decide for yourself what you want to use. So your pigs become trained to the single strand wire. And should something happen, if part of the wire is grounded out and they push past that, then you have your perimeter field fence as just an extra barrier while you tend to the part of your single strand that needs attention. And according to Mark, the reason pigs get out is not because they're thinking about it. They're not these calculated escape artists. They're rooters. And if you have something like a hog panel, and that's all you're using is some hog panels zip tied together, maybe a few T-posts here and there to stabilize your corners, this is not going to work. You will have escaping pigs, not because they are calculating their big escape. It's simply that pigs love to root, and they root on the ground. And so they're going to root as forward as they can until they meet resistance. And if it's an electric wire, well, they're trained to that and they don't like the feeling of it. And what happens if you're not using a wire and you're using just, say, cattle panels, is the pig will root right up to it, and there's never a little zap or a reason to really feel like they shouldn't go to the very edge. And then they just kind of root their way under the cattle panels, and they're big, they're heavy, they're strong, and they just sort of push them over and find their way onto the other side of them. So it's not like an on-purpose thing. They're not sitting there thinking, I want to get to the other side of this cattle panel. They're just rooting up to the edge of it, and through strength and continued rooting, they're just kind of making their way through it and compromising the integrity of the fencing, if it's just cattle panel or something similar, non-electric. And eventually they just find themselves on the other side of it. And now the pig's on the wrong side of the fence. And, you know, it's really difficult. They're in your garden. They're hard to get back in. All of those things that none of us would want to deal with. So as Mark said, when I learned this system from him, he had said, listen, you can use the method that I use, field fencing as a perimeter with a single strand electric about 12 inches off the ground. He said, you can use this method, or you could go ahead and use hog panels and enjoy chasing pigs. So I was like, well, that sells me, and I'm going to use his method. And we never had a pig escape once. I'm sold. I swear by it. Happy to endorse that system. And one final note on fencing here, and this is chalked up to what I mean by your attentive experience is going to be your best teacher, you know, because you just can't know everything before you start this. And so what I learned through raising pigs is that the way that their behavior is, they like to root the perimeter. So whatever the perimeter is that you give them, that's where they spend a lot of their time. They love to root in that area. So if they're just constantly not really secure by an electric strand, they're going to kind of naturally, instinctively push that perimeter out and out and out. Something to keep in mind. You know, you can really see where if that perimeter is not electrified, then in no time at all, they're just pushing their way right against and then eventually through something non-electric like a hog panel. And in case you're wondering if this is something like, you know, you don't have experience with this, which is totally fine, and you're like, oh my gosh, electrifying an animal's area. They dislike it so much that when they were babies and came home to us, they each touched that wire one time. And that's been it. They never touch the wire again. And it's not, I don't know the voltage offhand, but it's a zap. I mean, we've all been electrocuted as strongly as they are when they're being trained to the fence. So when I say they're trained to the fence, I'm not saying like it took 6 months or no. I mean, they each touched it one time and that was it. And they knew for the year that they were with us to never touch it again. Even when they moved from different paddocks, they just recognized that fence and they steered clear of it. Your pigs will need wallows. Now they will make the divot in the earth, but they're going to need you to fill it with water. And they require this as a way to stay cool. This is how they cool down. They don't sweat in the same way that other animals do. And so wallows is necessary. It's not a plaything. It's not optional. They require this. So think about your location. Think about if you're going to have to haul water, if you set up a little bit of rain catchment near where they are, if you're going to have a hose that can reach, whatever it may be, they are going to need a wallow. And the wallow will dissipate in time. But depending on how humid it is, if you've just had rain, there's a lot of variables. A wallow could last a couple of days or so. But boy, they love it. And I will say, if you can have a direct hose access to your wallow area, spray them down. They love it. Oh my gosh, it's like the most gleeful thing to spray a pig with a hose. I'm not sure who got more enjoyment out of this, us or them, but it's just a good time for everybody. So the way we had our setup was we have really, really long hoses here. We have multiple hoses linked together because we just need to for reaching a variety of places. So we were able to reach the areas where they wallowed, no problem. And in the summertime, the best thing, you know, right when that sun starts to get hot during the day around 10, 11 a.m., and they're kind of ready for their morning nap at that point anyways, give them some fresh water in their wallow and they will play so happily and then take a big snooze right in there. It's the best. Let's talk for a moment about feeding and watering. Watering is fairly self-explanatory. Obviously, you want it to be clean and freshened daily. I will say because we overwintered our pigs and we do live in a northern climate, I had to think about maintaining water throughout winter so it wouldn't freeze. And this was something that I might not have given as much thought to if my husband was home every day. We probably would have just gone out there, taken turns, you know, with an axe and broken up ice, and that would have been fine. But again, because I was alone, I was taking some preemptive steps in my whole setup for raising pigs. And one of them was that I knew I was going to go into winter wanting a water heater so that it would prevent the water from freezing. And what I wound up doing was going with a 50-gallon Rubbermaid tote that you can get at the feed store. And this was a good size because it's lower. So pigs are shorter than cows and horses. So you want this shorter size. And it was nice and wide. And then we picked up at the feed store also an electric heater. It's a coil heater. You insert it right into the basin. And we were kind of warned from the woman at the feed store who also raises pigs that, you know, pigs can be, again, they're just, it's not like they're not looking to be difficult, but they're very strong and they're very curious. So she has had experiences where her pigs kind of destroyed the in-basin water heaters. And so we were prepared for that to happen, but it didn't. Our pigs didn't care that it was in there, so they didn't harm it at all. It was electricity dependent, and we had a few power outages throughout the winter, but thankfully none that were long enough. Nothing ever froze solid. And if we did have a multi-day power outage where the trough did freeze, then I would have taken those few days and just gone out every few hours and just broken the surface with something heavy like a mallet or something. So if you're going to overwinter pigs in an area where you can expect it to freeze, I would personally recommend putting an electric heater into your trough. And it doesn't make the water warm. It just takes it to a high enough temperature that it doesn't freeze. Highly recommend that. Summer was actually a little bit trickier to keep their water nice because, as you might imagine by now, pigs like water and they like to make a mess of things and they're very, again, curious and playful. And so we found that any trough that we would put in their area, they would just lay in it, climb in it, knock it over, just made a fun time of it. And so we were constantly refilling it, to the point where I was actually concerned that they weren't getting enough water, because it's like every time you turned around, the trough is empty. And it's like, well, what if we need to leave the house for 3 hours? Like, this is something I'm concerned about when it's 90 degrees outside. And I know that 2 minutes after I left the driveway, they've dumped their entire trough. So we wound up getting an automatic waterer, which I think I have a photo that I can share with you, or at least I'll provide a link in the resources. It worked well. I wouldn't say I loved it, because it was just really hard. You know, their snouts are muddy and there's a lot of dirt, and the trough itself was pretty small. I mean, it was like maybe 10 inches across, and that's the idea of it. So they don't put their body into it. They literally can only get a drink, and they push a little tab on the waterer and that releases the water, and it needed to be hooked up through our hose. And so it was an on-demand waterer, and it worked great in terms of, like, I knew they would get water. In my opinion, they always seem to get muddy water because they were putting their muddy snouts into this small bowl. So it was like instantly muddy. Now, pigs don't seem to mind this, so I tried to like let that go in my mind, but you know, I wanted them to have like this pristine, crystal clear water every time they took a drink, and that was not realistic with this system. But it did give me peace of mind when we could not be at home. Next up, feeding. We have access to what is considered really decent organic pig pellet type feed, you know, chicken layer pellet as well. That is organic, and it's just it's a good quality as far as those things go. And that is what we started off with, organic pig pellet. But I knew there was soy in there, even though it was organic, so it's non-GMO. I just didn't love it, you know? And so once I got a little bit of time under my belt with them and a little bit more confidence, again, you're going to learn by doing, I felt like it was time to dig a little deeper and customize their feeding program a bit more. Now, we raise them in the summertime with tons of garden produce. I mean, they loved tomatoes. They love green beans. They aren't too big on brassicas in our experience, but there was just so much variety coming in the garden. You know, I'd throw them ears of corn. I mean, they were getting supplementation in that regard every single day, usually multiple times a day. And that was so much fun. Apples, oh my gosh. We have a big old apple tree that produces every other year, and last year was a producing year, and they were just massive, more than we could ever eat. So we really gave them a ton. We do not have oak trees here. I'm actually planting some this year, but I'll probably never see acorns in my lifetime. But if you have access to acorns, it is an excellent food. Not only is it free, but it's so nutritious for pigs, and you don't need to do anything to them. You know, if you're going to use acorns to make flour for yourself, there's a whole process where you have to soak and leach and remove the tannins. Not required for pigs whatsoever. Throw them in there. Oh my gosh, if you have acorns and apples, you are going to put such a big dent in your feed bill. We had no acorns. So we had the grain, we had the garden produce, and then eventually I gained a little bit of confidence and ventured into kind of formulating my own feed. And I am not in a position to share any kind of recipe for that whatsoever, but I will link a blog post for you that was the guide that got me going. In this blog post, it was a mixture of, I can't remember their exact mixture, but I wound up using field peas, corn, oats, and barley, all of which I bought from Azure Standard, organic, in 50-pound bags. And I customized my own blend with Redmond salt for minerals. I initially started just soaking it, and then I was like, well, I'm going to see if I can ferment this. And so I started fermenting it. They really didn't love the ferment as much, so I pulled back on that a bit and was going with at least a 24-hour soak. And the reason you want to soak the grains rather than just put a dry mixture out there, like, they'll probably eat a dry mixture, You want them to have access to the nutrition within those grains. So just as we know as humans that soaking our whole grains coaxes them open and neutralizes the phytic acid, which will bind minerals so we don't absorb certain minerals in the grains, we need to take care of that. And so it's the same thing with them. Like, they'll eat the dry grains, but we want them to actually be able to access the nutrition within those grains. So soaking them for, I did at least 24 hours. I was really trying to go longer to get that sprout going, and I played around with the timing. I was not incredibly rigid about it, but I did soak them for at least 24 hours, and that was their favorite. You know, they liked it at that point versus when I took it longer and fermented it. And then two more things relating to how we fed them. One, we grew a ton of winter squash and pumpkins last year on purpose because we knew we could just literally put them on a shelf in our cold room and they would feed our pigs as supplementation all winter long. Now, they do like it if you smash them open. They love it if you're going to take the time to roast them. So often I would, if I was baking bread or a roast, or if I had my oven going for any reason, I would very often just throw a pumpkin in there. I didn't even always cut it. I would just put it in whole. I'd pierce a couple holes in it so it didn't explode. A whole squash, anything like that, put it in the oven. You could do this with beets, turnips, anything. They really love it roasted. At the very least, cut it up if you can. So they're not just like accessing a whole pumpkin with a skin, you know, no flesh exposed. You'll find early in the season that they will enjoy a whole pumpkin thrown into their pen because it's new and they're excited and curious, but then they get tired of it if they have to do the work all the time. So at the very least, I would say smash them open. And if you're feeling especially generous, go ahead and cook or roast. And then the final component to their feed, which I knew going into this that this would be kind of like a weak link in our setup, but I didn't allow it to stop me from proceeding, but definitely raising them confirmed this. And that is that raising pigs without a dairy animal on your farm is, I don't want to say it's not a good idea, but it's an expensive idea. I mean, I literally bought raw milk for them because it is such a wonderful thing to provide calories, better calories than certainly like the pig pellets, you know, if you're going to be going that route just from the feed store. So much nutrition. They love it. Good fats, good proteins. Oh my gosh, it's wonderful. And if you have dairy animals, particularly cows, but even for some people, if you're milking a few goats, you might even have a surplus that is more than your family can use. So it's like a win-win for everybody. I mean, this is how a really resilient farm is set up. Everything feeds the next one. You know, it's just like a beautiful circular system. We didn't have that. And I knew it going into it, confirmed by doing it. I imagine that I would want to address that before I proceeded with raising pigs again, which we are not doing this year. Pigs are companion animals, and so you really want to raise more than one at a time. So we raised the two, and we did that on purpose, obviously, because you need to, but also because the plan was we'll do this every other year. We'll raise pigs. Taking this year off and looking forward to next time, seeing if I can refine that dairy piece a bit by having something here. Okay, and then there is something called LOOP, L-O-O-P, a LOOP program, and I don't know anything about it, but I do know of a lot of people who raise pigs that are connected through this LOOP program, which links you up to various businesses, restaurants, grocery stores in your area, and allows you to schedule pickup days for your farm. And you get all the scraps, all the extra vegetables that they've deemed are trash for whatever reason. I think sometimes there's even other foods in there too, like breads and maybe some dairy. So don't quote me on if it's only produce, because like I said, I'm not familiar with it. The reason that I didn't even look into it was because, one, I knew I was growing plenty of produce to supplement in that regard. So it really would have only been like the dairy that I would have required. But also, I just don't live near anywhere it would be convenient or even practical to go to a couple times a week to pick up my load for the animals. It just didn't make any kind of logistical sense for us, for our location. So I skipped out on that, but I'll see if I can find a link for you for the Loop program to see if it's something that you can find in your area. Because I do know a lot of people that find this to be a great supplementation for raising pigs. I don't believe I've mentioned this yet, but we chose to name our pigs. I think specifically I did, and I think that my husband actually was a little unsure of that at first. But I chose to name them for a specific reason. I wanted that deeper connection. I wanted them to have a place here, an identity, because I revere their life and their purpose. So we went ahead and I named them Maggie and Clover. Clover was our blonde, or the lighter one. I named her Clover simply because her coloring is, it just was exactly that of a white clover. So she was Clover. And Maggie is actually short for Marguerite, which is the name of my great-great-grandmother. I've spoken of her before here in Hearth and Home. I read a story that my cousin Lucian had written about his childhood visiting our family farm in Eagle Lake, and this predates my lifetime. He's older than I am. The family farm was where my great-grandfather grew up. His mother, Marguerite, was the matriarch, and she is spoken about in the story that I've read here on Hearth and Home, and I'll provide a link if you've never listened to that podcast. That was a fun one. I needed that connection because I knew that the day would come where the deed needed to be done, because they're not pets. They came here as food, and they will leave here as food. I knew that I would love these animals, and that's okay. It's okay to love an animal and know that it is food. In fact, I would argue that's the best way to relate to your food. And for me, I've spoken about this before too. I don't have a real separation in my love and reverence for my food between plants and animals. When I scorched the maple pan this year and destroyed at least a half a gallon, if not more, of finished syrup, I cried over that. It was really devastating for me, because what it took for our trees to give that much volume, and I ruined it, and I just felt so bad. So for me, they're one and the same. However, the day is hard, and I knew it would be, and so I chose to name her Marguerite, because it would steal me in the moment when it was about to happen. My great-great-grandmother, who I never met, but just in legend, would be there with me, reminding me, like, child, this is the circle of it all, and this is the next thing that needs to happen here. It's okay. I just wanted that because she was a strong woman. I mean, they did it all. I mean, if it wasn't coffee or salt, they raised it. I mean, they raised wheat and everything, all the meat, all the butter, all the dairy, all the fruits, everything. And then what they didn't raise, they hunted and foraged. So truly a family farm in the first half of the last century. So Clover and Maggie, if I hadn't properly introduced you to them yet, this is who they were. In this next part, we are going to discuss the day of the kill and how that went, what took place, and some details that might be helpful to you if you see yourself doing this in the future. So many people nowadays are getting more and more into the raising of their own food, including meat. And this is fantastic. This is, I mean, you want food sovereignty if you can make that happen. But for most of us doing this, we didn't grow up this way. I mean, we're about two generations removed from this being the norm. So personally, though, I did grow up in an avid hunting family, and my husband has always hunted as well. So I do have a lot of lived experience around butchering and eating animals that do not come from a tidy grocery store package. Butchering is something I am comfortable with and I actually enjoy it, which sounds strange, but there's a real anatomical process going on that to me is kind of satisfying. I understand it. It seems to be instinctual for me and I do enjoy it. But my skill and experience with the killing, less so. My father, my husband are out in the woods hunting the animals. I do aspire to hunt, but have not yet. So that aspect of it, I had no experience or confidence with. And my husband, though he has killed quite a few animals for our food, two things. One, there's a very different dynamic for a hunter than raising a domesticated animal. When he is in the woods, it's very much a prey versus predator kind of experience. And I know that might sound strange and maybe even not good to somebody who, you know, can't relate to that sort of a thing, but this is normal for people who hunt and fish. There is that very distinct dynamic. But he knew that he would have a relationship with these pigs and that it would not feel like predator and prey. It still needed to be done, but he just wasn't sure. You know, it's not that he didn't have the stomach for it. It's a very different experience than hunting. And furthermore, and this is even more so, pigs have a very small brain, which is kind of surprising because they're really smart animals. They're so cool. They have so much personality. It's kind of surprising that their brains are so small. So it makes it a little bit of a hard target. And there's a very specific like quarter size target that you need to get. And you also need to get the trajectory right with your bullet to make it a good clean shot. And we didn't want this to go badly. Like more than anything else, this mattered to us. And so we are fortunate to live in an area where finding people to do on-farm slaughter is a very reasonable thing. There's people that do it all over the place. Now, I'm more familiar with people who do chickens because that's what we've done before. So I did have a little bit of trouble finding somebody to do the pigs, but one of you, Kristen, who lives a little ways from me, she's about an hour or so away from me. She had mentioned somebody that did her pigs. And so I got their phone number and called them. And he was willing to drive this far. He lives over that way too. And he was willing to drive this far and do the job for us. And I will say that after I had made the appointment with this gentleman, Dan, my neighbor said, "Oh my gosh, why didn't you just ask me? Like, people do our pigs." And that's how it is here. Like when I talk about where I live now and the skills that people have around here, like everybody does this sort of thing. We're not like the odd people raising animals for food here. This is how it is when you live rural. So yeah, my neighbor was like, "Oh, next time, you know, Heather, he lives right down the road and he can come and do this for you next time." So anyway, we did hire Dan, recommended by Kristen, and he was so kind. And the way his process works is he charges you X amount per pig. And for him, it was $75, which I think is woefully underpriced. He shoots the pig, sticks the pig to bleed. You do need to provide a tractor to haul the pig out of the pen. And then his preference is to skin the pig, which I can talk about in a second. And then he halves the pig and guts it and leaves you with the rest. Now you can either take it to a slaughterhouse and have them cut, or a meat person and have them cut and wrap it, or you can do it yourself. And we did know that we wanted to do it ourselves. When I was initially on the phone with Dan, very honestly talking with him, like just saying, "Hey, like we could probably do this if we needed to, but I want it to go well," because there are a lot of people who, when they raise animals, the expression is that your animal only has one bad day. That's what you want out of your meat. You want them to have one bad day. To me, that's not good enough. I want our animals to have one bad second at the very most. I mean, I want it to be instant. We did not have the confidence in ourselves that we could make that happen. So no shame. My whole point of all this is there's absolutely no shame if you feel it is in the best interest of the animal to hire out that kill. There are people that do this professionally for a reason. And what mattered to us was that the animals died on this farm, that they were in their home, in their paddock, and that they were drinking raw milk as it happened. That's what mattered to us. Who pulled the trigger was going to be the most skilled person that we could find. If this is something that you are doing for the first time as well, whether or not you plan to do the kill yourself or have somebody come to the farm and do the kill for you, I would recommend that you think the day through and plan accordingly to the best of your ability. And what I mean by this, when I was on the phone with Dan, I asked him, what do you need from us to make this go well for you? It's not going to take much effort for me to set up whatever he needs. So this is swift. I mean, I want a split second at the most for my animals to be taken down. So he had told me, one, yep, you're going to need a tractor. We don't have a tractor. So my husband's uncle, who lives here on the ridge, he used to have so much equipment. I mean, dump trucks and backhoes and everything, but he's older now. And so he has sold a lot of his equipment, but he has kept his skid steer and he will keep that to the day he dies. So he brought his skid steer down so we could use that because you need that to hang the pigs from. Dan had said, other than that, it would be really helpful to have the pigs corralled into a small 10 by 10 area. I have a photo of what we did, and I'm going to share it with you in the related post for this podcast because he commented to me that it was perfect. Like when he got here and he saw it, he said, this setup is perfect. And I wish that all of my clients had it just like this. The last thing somebody needs to be doing is chasing a pig around a quarter acre area, especially if it's muddy, looking for that perfect shot. So I thought, okay, you tell me to do that. That's what I'm going to do. Directly in front of their shelter, early that morning, the day of the kill, we went out so early, like 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. It's getting light out earlier now, so that was possible. And we simply took two cattle panels. We put some T-posts into the ground from the front of their shelter to the front edge of the fence in their paddock. And that was probably about a 10 to 12 foot distance. We put one cattle panel up on one side first. And while we were doing that, it kind of stirred the pigs out of their slumber. They were sleeping in their shelter. And so they were like, oh, we're going to get up and go see what's going on. And they came out of their shelter, went and used the bathroom, got a drink, kind of enjoyed their morning for a half an hour or so. And then my husband started putting up the second panel, and they were really curious about that. So they came back to their shelter. This went beautifully. This is exactly what I was hoping for. I was hoping that they would just be so curious as to what we were doing that they came back and settled into that space. And they did. It was beautiful. I was like, this is so exactly what we're hoping for here. No stress. Again, right? Like one bad second. So this was about maybe 6:30, 6:45 that we had them in there with both cattle panels on either side. Again, refer to the photo. And they had already had a drink. They went use the bathroom, had a little bit of time, you know, out in their area in the paddock for the morning. Now they're back in their little shelter, ready to go have a nap. So we had the two sides up. The pigs were contained in there. And then we went ahead and put down two bales of straw for two reasons. It just so happened to be cold that day, so there was no issue with mud. The ground was quite firm. It was only about 28 degrees that morning. Perfect. I just thought it would provide a cleaner undersurface. I mean, there's going to be blood, which can make it muddy. You know, I mean, again, it turned out that it was quite cold, so I don't think that would have been a problem. But if you're dealing with a warmer day, I just wanted to keep the mud to a minimum. I wanted to keep the pigs clean. I wanted them to be comfortable. But then the icing on the cake was that pigs love getting fresh straw. It's so exciting to them. They toss it around and make a nest, and they're so happy. It gave them just that last bit of like super fun entertainment. And that was a real joy for me to watch them be happy in that moment. So right now we're at about 6:45 in the morning, and I knew Dan was coming at 7. He was running a little bit late that morning, but it was fine. They were totally settled, enjoying their straw nest, basking in the morning sunshine, drinking raw milk. Then Dan got here and he brought his father with him. It was about 7:30. And I mentioned this time because it was important to me that this happened first thing in the morning. And when I had asked Dan, I mean, I knew he was traveling at least an hour. And I said, you know, how early can you come? He said, I can come at sunrise if you want. And I was like, this is amazing. Like, this is somebody who gets it. We butcher our chickens or we slaughter our chickens in the same way, like first thing in the morning. So the timing was great. Their little corral was great. They were content and sleeping and nesting in their fresh 2 bales of straw. And Dan arrived and he took just a moment to assess and compose himself. And I appreciated this because he even said to us, he said, you know, no matter how many times you do this, there's that moment of adrenaline before you take the shot. So I appreciated the honesty because, you know, we're all human. And so even if this is what you do professionally, it's nice to know that you still feel it because it's a big deal to kill an animal. I was a little concerned that the gun would be loud. I didn't know what kind of gun he used. And I was like, you know, thinking of our dog who panics when there's a gunshot, and we had another dog visiting and she panics when there's a gunshot. So I brought the dogs into the house and put them inside. Now, Dan had to do this one pig at a time. And I do wish there was a way that it could be both simultaneously. And maybe other people do know of a way to make it happen simultaneously, but he did do them one at a time. So he took a moment, composed himself, prepared for his shot. His gun wound up being quiet, and we had asked him what he used. It was a .38 rifle, which is kind of an unusual gun. Wasn't expecting that, but that's what he used, and it was a quiet shot, so it didn't disturb the dogs. It didn't disturb the other pig. It was just a pop. It wasn't loud at all. And it was instant. His shot was great. His stick was great. And we got the first pig, Clover, out of there. His process was to hang her, skin her, gut her, have her before he moved on to the second kill. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I do wish that they could have gone more closely together. And I suppose if we had complete control over that, then we could have made that happen. So a little bit of a lesson learned there. I don't know if another person could do it differently, but this was his method. I will say that Maggie, the remaining pig in that interim there, she took a nap. She just lay down in the sunshine and we gave her some more raw milk. It was not traumatic for her. That could be detected in any way. Leading up to this day, I had subscribed to Abundance Plus, which is an app that is created by Justin Rhodes of Abundant Permaculture, I think is his channel name. Within that app, he has a whole kind of masterclass series with the Meatsmith, and I cannot remember his actual name, but his handle is the Meatsmith. He went through a multi-video process of killing, sticking, scalding and scraping, because that is what they did for their pigs, and butchering the pigs. And my husband and I watched those videos leading up to the week. And even though we weren't doing the killing ourselves, it just gave us so much information. I don't want to say confidence, because it's a sobering thing, but it just gave us like a real deep understanding of what to expect every step of the way. So I highly recommend checking that out. And after the fact, I learned that the Meatsmith also has a subscription membership through his own site that might be even more comprehensive. I'm not sure. I haven't checked that out, but that might be something to look into. But he was so knowledgeable, and we really learned a lot about the process. The other thing, if I could change it and do it more our way, which again, you might have to make some concessions if you're hiring out the kill, was I probably would have preferred scalding and scraping rather than skinning. We did save their skins and we put them in the freezer and do plan to utilize them. The nice thing though is because we raised Mangalitsas and they have such a significant fat cap, there was no loss of fat. And Dan even asked, he said, do you want me to make sure that as much fat stays on the animal as possible when I skin it? And I said, yes, please. And he really did. I mean, he just took the skin off. So, but it is typical for most people to just scald and scrape. And Dan's preference is for skinning. So I guess my parting thoughts on the day of the kill: don't be a hero if you feel that you will get a better kill by hiring that out. Then go for it. The more important part to me was that our animals died here and that we did the butchering because we felt we would best utilize every bit of the animal. And we are. We're still in the process of it, but we are. If you are hiring it out, ask the person who's doing the kill what they need from you as you enter that day. See if you can make it happen as early as possible, and then set it up in a way that makes it easy for the person shooting and especially easy and comfortable for the animals. Once Dan was finished with his work, he and his father went on their way, and the rest was up to us. We didn't really have much to do that day, the day of the kill. Once they were hanging, they needed to hang there overnight for the meat to be ready to butcher. But this was outdoors for us, and I will provide a photo for you. My husband built like a large arch to hang them from. We did need to protect them, though, from potential predators overnight, and so we used one of our electric poultry netting fences and circled that around the area, and it worked out great. The temperature was cool. I mean, you have to choose your days on the calendar and when you're how you're going to raise your animals. You don't want to butcher in August if you can help it. My gosh, that sounds terrible. We needed a cool day. We knew where we live. April is still very cool. The weather worked out perfect. I mean, the outdoors was just an absolute refrigerator, even got down to just touching freezing overnight. It was perfect. So they just had to hang on day one. Now, the following 2 days were where our work took place. This part of the process felt more comfortable for us. We have a fair amount of experience with butchering, but I will say, you know, you always learn new things. We have obviously never butchered a pig before. We've mostly butchered deer. A pig has a lot more fat on it, and so I actually found it a little bit more almost confusing anatomically to butcher pigs than deer, because deer are so lean that when you have a deer open and are looking at it, you know, once it's skinned, it's very clear where the muscle groups are. And that is really the essence of butchering, is just breaking apart the anatomy. With pigs, there's so much more lard and fat interwoven that it can be a little bit tricky to just see what's what, at least for these particular lard breeds of pigs that we raised. That was interesting. I will say, referencing those Meatsmith videos that I mentioned earlier, really helped us a lot, and I would truly recommend that. I mean, we were absolutely those people there with the laptop on the table watching the videos as we were doing it, at least for the first half. Once we got to the fourth half, it was fine. We didn't need them anymore. But certainly for the first one or two halves, like, it's okay to be learning it as you go and having a video playing so you're making your right cuts. But leading up to the butchering, I went ahead and just set up the area as I saw or imagined we would need it to be set up. So I had all different stations throughout our kitchen and dining room. And again, I will provide photos for you. We had a big cutting table, and we had a large cutting board with, I had a protective outdoor picnic tablecloth over the table. I had multiple bins to sort the meat and different parts into. We had a meat grinding station. We had a meat wrapping station, a vacuum sealing station, a knife station where we had stacks of clean rags, you know, not too special of our dish towels. We had knives and sharpeners and these clean rags in one area, gloves, many gloves, because you're going to need to change them a few times throughout the day. Just go into your butchering days with as much consideration given to the setup as you can possibly give. You're going to need more surfaces than you think you'll need. You're going to need more vessels to hold things than you think you'll need. You're going to need wrapping supplies. You basically need a plan. Is your freezer cleaned out and ready? These are the sort of things that I probably took a little bit of my childhood experience with my father into this day, because my father was very much that way too. He had his all his little systems set up in his different areas, And, you know, we had our own spin on it, of course, but I certainly understood the importance of going into it with a plan and efficiency and also cleanliness. It helps you to stay organized, which helps things to stay clean. And of course, that's what you want. Part of having your plan in place is to also think ahead of time how you want to use the animal. So it's not just about butchering, but it's about cooking. Like, how are you going to cook this animal? Are you looking to do hams? Are you looking to do prosciutto? Are you wanting more charcuterie? Do you like chops? Do you like roasts? Do you want a lot of sausage? You know, so on and on. And I knew that I wasn't going to explore all realms of charcuterie with our first attempt. But of course, I did want to make bacon. I did want to make lardo. I did want to make gâton, which is a seasoned pork spread that is a staple in my French Canadian heritage. We wanted to be sure that we smoked ham hocks. We wanted to have as many chops as possible, and not necessarily from the loin, but from the shoulders. We love shoulder chops. Just have a plan, and it doesn't have to be perfect. Like, you're not necessarily going to be a professional butcher at this point and get it exactly right. Because honestly, you can always make stew meat. You can always make sausage if you don't get all of your cuts perfect. One thing we have always done with venison, and we borrowed a little bit of this thinking with the pigs as well, when we wrap venison, we wrap almost everything that can be wrapped as a roast. However, we don't really love venison roasts because it's so lean. It's just like not really, in our opinion, the best roast, but it does make good steak. So what we do is we wrap our roasts because they're just better protected in the freezer as a whole roast than if they were to be cut individually as steaks. And then when it's time to take one out, we'll let it thaw and then slice it into steaks and grill those or cook them in the cast iron pan. And that way we can get that nice medium rare to rare meat temperature out of it. It just works really well. It makes it easier on processing day. It better protects the meat in the freezer because it's just one like lump of meat versus many slices of meat with more air exposure, or potential air exposure, I should say. So we took that same principle and did that with some of our cuts of pork. We really love shoulder chops on pork, but it actually was one thing that was really difficult because we don't have a band saw, and the shoulder chop has a bone in it. I mean, we would have been there all day hand sawing this, which we did. We do have a bone saw, but we would have been there all day. So we deboned it, cut it into a roast, wrapped them as roasts, and then when we want to have those for dinner, we'll take out the roast and we cut them into small enough portions where it would make sense. They're not like 8-pound roasts that we would then have to make steak with. And then we can take them out of the freezer and cut them into steaks and cook them in the cast iron real quick. And that is one of our favorite ways to eat pork chop, is cooked in the cast iron skillet. Overall, the butchering took us 2 days, and that was longer than we thought it would take, but it was also fine. We weren't like doing this from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. I mean, we were surprised at how familiar it felt because we have butchering experience, but also how different, because with all the fat content in a pig, it just made it a little bit more mysterious. And we also wanted to be careful. We didn't want to rush it. We wanted to utilize every bit of this animal. And so we took our time, and I'm glad that we did. We had the 2 days to give to it. We had planned for it. It worked out fine. My husband did the bulk of the breaking down, and then I would do the wrapping, and he would sort out little pieces were going into the sausage grind bucket, and I would keep track of that. Pieces that were going into the lard bucket, of course, we separated out the leaf lard, which is the fat that is directly around the kidneys of the animal. We render that separately because it is premium. I did the rendering. I also wrapped up everything that is going to be for sausage grind and froze it, and we will make sausage at a later date. And you can do this. You can plan the process to be what you need it to be. And the reason that I didn't want to rush into making the sausage is because I'm not set yet on my sausage recipe. And before I take all of this meat, there's so much sausage grind, before I take all of that and mix up a bunch of spices with it, I want to dial in my recipe first. So from another farm, I have several pounds of ground pork in our freezer, just plain ground pork, and I'm going to use that to trial a few different sausage recipes until I can nail that perfect one that we want to make en masse, and then go ahead, pull all of the ground meat, or it's not even ground yet, we just call it grind because it's all the little scraps that we just froze. We'll pull them out, grind them, season them when we get that perfect recipe decided on, and then we'll package it up. So you can do that same thing. Like, we haven't smoked our bacon yet. We still have to build our smokehouse. So we wrapped all of the bacons very well. Those are in the freezer. The hams are in the freezer. The hocks are in the freezer. Even the lard that I will be making the lardo with is in the freezer, and I will get to that at a later date. So what I've been working on is rendered all the lard. I've made 7 gallons of broth with all of the bones. And now I am going through and using the meaty bits that were left over from the broth making and making gratin, which is that seasoned pork spread. And then down the road, we'll do all of our smoking. We'll do all of our sausage making. We'll cure that lardo. I had really wanted to do a prosciutto, and we just didn't get to it. We really ran out of steam. So all of the hams are in the freezer, and I'll have to look up and see if I can pull one out and do prosciutto after the fact, because I think that we have as good a setup as any to do a prosciutto, and that would certainly be incredible to have. So overall, I think the butchering went really well. Definitely recommend going into it with a plan, and you don't have to be super rigid about your plan. It's okay if your plan evolves. Ours certainly did, but have an idea of how you want to cook your pig in various ways, rather than just break it down based on muscles and freeze it. Like, really think about how you will use that pig in your cooking. Have as many surfaces as you can, lots of vessels to put things in, all of your different stations for wrapping. Even if you have to put a folding table in your kitchen to create more surface space, you will not regret it. And do check out a resource like the Meatsmith if you would benefit from that kind of teaching. It certainly helped us an awful lot. Let's close this out. There's so much to cover, and I really appreciate your time. I know that we are not all interested in this sort of thing, but I also realize that enough of us are. Even those of us who aren't necessarily going to do this for ourselves, we want to know how it's done because we do care about the process and our food. So hopefully, whether or not you are going to be raising your own pigs, hopefully you found some value to this. What I am sharing with you is a completely novice perspective, and that was why I thought it was important to sit down, press record, and just talk to you today, because there's no shortage out there of people who are really good at this and have a lot of experience doing this. But, you know, as a new person to it, there were some very distinct takeaways, things that I would do differently and things that went beautifully. So just sharing our experience, and I always love to hear the stories of other people's experiences as well. It also felt really important to me to give time and acknowledgement to Clover and Maggie, because they were the very best introduction to larger livestock that I could ever have asked for. I loved those pigs. I do miss those pigs. And it also felt so right to be so intimately connected to our food in this way. I will try to provide as many resources for you and photos in the post as I can. If you have further questions, please reach out. If you just want to share your own experiences, if you want to add your own experiences, I'm sure there's so many things that I didn't cover here. Even those of you who have done this a dozen times over, tell me what I should know moving forward and what would be even more helpful. I just really appreciate your kindness in this topic. I know it is sensitive, and I look forward to carrying on this conversation with you in our community. Thank you so much for listening, and please, until next time, take care of yourselves and take care of each other.